Hello. Welcome to our podcast, Blethers With, which accompanies our textbook, Criminal Justice in Scotland, published by Routledge. This episode is a blether with Dr. Amy Cullen, who recently completed a PhD at the University of Glasgow on criminal fines and how they're enforced in Scotland. In our conversation, Amy talks me through what happens when somebody can't pay a fine in Scotland and the connections between fines, other penalties, and wider patterns of inequality. We also reflect on the failure of criminology to properly study fines, and Amy offers some advice for people who might be thinking about a PhD themselves. This episode accompanies Chapter 5 of the book, but you're welcome to listen to it on its own. Either way, thanks for listening. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Blethers With. I'm Jamie Buchan. I'm a lecturer in criminology at Edinburgh Napier University. And today we're having a blether with Amy Cullen, a PhD student at the University of Glasgow, who has just submitted a PhD about fines. Amy, what's the title of your PhD?
My thesis title is Enforcement, Extension and Entanglement, Punishing Non-Payment of Financial Penalties in Scotland.
That sounds fascinating, Amy. And congratulations as well on submitting your PhD.
Thank you. It does feel quite lovely. And it has been a real journey with the work. And I am so interested and deeply fascinated by fines and financial penalties. So I am really excited to get the chance to kind of delve into them with you.
Brilliant. I'm very glad to hear it. Well, shall we start off then by asking you just to tell us a bit about your research project?
My project aims to offer a critical account of fines and fines enforcement in contemporary Scotland. Fines enforcement generally refers to a range of measures, procedures and sanctions that are used to respond to the non-payment of fines and financial penalties. I've tried in my work to build a more critical account of what's actually happening when people don't and can't pay a fine, drawing on existing research internationally and in Scotland, and publicly available administrative statistical data and a small number of qualitative interviews with community justice practitioners who work with people who've been fined in Scotland. Overall, the research project is an attempt to try and build a picture of what's happening when people can't pay a fine or a financial penalty as a way of inspiring conversations about the way that we conceptualize fines and fining. And I'm quite keen to argue that we start understanding it as a process rather than a thing, and that we can then have more detailed conversations about how fines can potentially affect and be experienced differently in different contexts. What I found primarily is a really complicated web of fines enforcement. So lots of different measures and procedures and forms of sanctions happening that were in a lot of cases affecting already economically marginalized people or people who were in regular or repeated contact with the criminal legal system. And it's probably no surprise that there's a cyclical element to some of the fines enforcement processes. So there are incidences of multiple fines, repeated fines, kind of cycles where a fine's imposed, fines enforcement action follows, and then another fine is imposed, and then more fines enforcement action follows. So in some cases, this really extends the length of time that people are in contact with the criminal legal system. And it can be a very specific kind of contact that I don't think we have quite articulated before.
Okay, thank you. Well, that leads me nicely onto the next question, which is if a person is convicted of an offence, they're given a fine by the courts. We know, of course, that that's the most common outcome statistically for convictions, is that it's a fine. What happens if that person doesn't pay the fine or can't pay the fine? What happens next?
So for anybody who can't or doesn't pay a fine, whether it's a court fine or actually some other type of financial penalty, which in Scotland is a really key point, Scotland is essentially unique in the UK for the range of fines and financial penalties that are actually operating within the entirety of the criminal legal system. There are a lot of, there's a huge number and a great reliance on out-of-court financial penalties. Almost all out-of-court methods are financial in some way. Someone who didn't pay any of, you know, didn't pay any one of those forms of a financial penalty would be placed under some form of fines enforcement action. Fines enforcement is centralised in Scotland. Overall responsibilities with the Scottish Courts and Tribunals Service, and fines enforcement teams do a lot of the administration of certain kinds of methods and procedures. Including in some cases crossover work with other agencies like the Department of Work and Pensions or Criminal Justice Social Work. Types of fines enforcement, I think we need to understand that in the first instance that can include things like time to pay, payment in installment, payment schedules, which can seem relatively benign, I think. But lack of adherence to things like a payment schedule or time to pay might result in other methods being employed. A good example is bank account or earnings arrestment, so directly garnishing someone's wages. But as the data shows, in almost half of all cases, payment is being claimed directly from people's benefits via a deduction order, which again is a form of enforcement action. There can be further action taken by the court as a result of non-payment. And whilst it is rare, it is actually still possible to end up in custody or even imprisoned as a result of unpaid fines. It's not very common. That's not to say that it never happens. And there are also a kind of range of ways in which fines and experiences of custody kind of overlap anyway. I think what's really important to kind of highlight, what my work really attempts to highlight, is I do think that there is an assumption that these are kind of everyday, but not, what's wrong with time to pay? And there is a strong argument, well, what's wrong with time to pay? But you are extending people's contact with the criminal legal system. And because these methods are subject to so much less scrutiny, and there is currently so little robust data available to really illuminate how they work, I think that being aware of that extension and having conversations about what it means to have that kind of extended contact and what the nature of it is like is really important. And fundamentally, these methods don't engage with situations where people cannot at baseline afford to pay their fine. This is how you get these compounded and cyclical scenarios where people accrue multiple fines and might be paying back fines minimally for years at a time. As it stands, the Scottish Courts and Tribunals system, within their data, estimates that it takes 3 years. That's the figure on which they base their data collection. So it's a 3-year collection period at minimum on average. And I guess the bigger question about what happens when somebody can't or doesn't pay a fine, there is a kind of conceptual part to it, which is that if we can accept there's the potential for these long periods of contact, I think that there's a discussion to be had about the extent to which fines and fines enforcement might have implications for types of desistance-focused and rehabilitative or reintegrative practice, especially in terms of the work that community justice practitioners are doing. I think that it's possible to theorise that there are some under-recognised impacts of fines and of this kind of long-term fines enforcement that show that both deprivation of financial resources as well as exposure to fines enforcement might produce additional outcomes in the lives of those living with unpaid fines. And that's really a big answer to the small question. But like, it is what I think is so interesting about delving into some of these slightly more benign and bureaucratic seeming aspects of the criminal legal system. I think what is important to highlight is, especially for people who are regularly or repeatedly in contact with the criminal legal system, there's a potential for lots of disruptions to scheduled payments, to time to pay, payment in installments, certainly on that level. And there's also a sort of kinds of prioritization, I think, of which form of punishment needs to get dealt with first. And often I think that leads to fines and financial punishments being left to the end. And that's certainly something that comes out in international research from Europe, which is about punishment debt and how people are, lots of people who have had regular or repeated experiences of punishment and of the criminal legal system are often, once they have served all their other sentences, left with this kind of mound of punishment debt. Now, this often and pretty much always includes fines and financial penalties, but depending on the jurisdiction, it can also include things like fees. Fees and levies, that's a big one in the States, where a lot of the punishment debt research is really delving into that. It's not so much that it's not really so much the case in the Scottish context, but equally we end up, as we always do with fines and financial punishments, with me going, I'm not sure, I don't know, and I don't know quite what that experience feels like. And that is why I think we need much more research that kind of delves into that.
Thank you, Amy. To pick up on this point about punishments and the sort of connections between fines and other forms of punishment, you mentioned there that you saw some overlaps between the experience of being fined and the experience of being held in custody. I wondered if you could comment a bit more on that.
I think we just need to be sensitive to the fact that for some people, unpaid fines produce a warrant, and in some cases, the warrant results in a short stay in custody before you end up going to court. Equally, the accrual of a number of fines for certain kinds of offences often underlies a kind of pattern of like contact with the criminal legal system, where the same issues are coming up again and again and are fundamentally not being engaged with meaningfully. So I wouldn't want to claim you don't pay a fine and you go to prison. In fact, the focus on fines enforcement and the increase in the use and range of financial penalties available in Scotland since the 2000s has been nominally very focused on reducing imprisonment for non-payment. However, whilst we might have these very good rhetorical aims for our criminal legal policy, a lot of the time, especially when it comes to fines and financial penalties, I have struggled to understand what the justification is beyond saying we've removed imprisonment. Therefore, there isn't really any inequity there. There aren't really any problems. And something that is really striking, and one of the reasons why Scotland is such an interesting case study, is that the conversation about changes to fine setting and sentencing, which is happening in Europe and being offered as, again, nominally the more progressive approach to the fundamental problems of inequality that are inherent in forms of financial punishment, was sort of bypassed in the mid-2000s. What was offered instead was a very rationalized bureaucratic model of centralized fines enforcement, which is a very divergent set of practices from what is happening in a lot of these European countries that are often called upon when we talk about more progressive penal practice. And I think, again, that's really interesting. I have not really seen a sort of standalone justification. There are certainly some points about efficiency, about cost saving, about streamlining processes, but I don't know that we've fully had a conversation about where we as criminologists, where we assume efficacy and ethics is based in financial punishment. Just because we know, for example, it's very rarely rehabilitative. We know, for example, it very rarely engages with the context of people's lives. And we know, and have always known, that at baseline, there is an inequality at work there. And those conversations, I think, could be a little bit, I would love to see them being integrated into some of the great conversations we're having, across the world about the legitimacy and efficacy and ethics of different forms of punishment.
Thank you. And you mentioned that you saw Europe or certain countries in Europe as having gone through a conversation about this in the 2000s. Would you have any particular examples in mind there?
So Scotland had its conversation in the 2000s. There's been I couldn't tell you when all these countries started to move towards day fine models. Day fine models tend to be what is used in other jurisdictions to address inequalities in fining. I assume you talk about it in the book chapter.
We do, yes.
But essentially, it's just a way of calculating fines so that they are more responsive to people's financial context, whether that be income or all kinds of things. Different countries use different models. There's a really great book about it, which I recommend to everyone, which is Feraldo Cubana's The History of the Penal Fine. It's absolutely fascinating. But what we have started to see, and again from the small literature, there's starting to be a real nuanced conversation, is about the divergence of fines enforcement regimes and sort of fine setting regimes. How do we address the problem of people not being able to pay? Is it a bureaucratic problem at the point of collection, or is it a more sort of structural problem at the point of sentencing? I think both, if I can remember off the top of my head, I think both Switzerland and Germany have quite extensive day fine systems. I know from looking at, again, scant research about it, but I know from what I've accessed, it's not a panacea by any stretch of the imagination. There are actually problems with enforcement when it comes to day fine models, but conceptually, at least, there is an attempt to engage with more abstract global questions about inequality and about the relationship between economic marginalization and offending and criminalization that I think, even from a sort of conceptual standpoint, has a lot to offer, especially in somewhere like Scotland, where we're still having these really big debates about progressive punishment and person-centered punishment. And there's something about the fact that Scotland opted for a fines enforcement model that I think really needs to be revisited in light of some of these kind of bigger rhetorical claims around person-centered justice and rehabilitation and reintegrative practice. The whole point of the expansion of financial penalties in the mid-2000s was primarily to reduce a burden on the Scottish court system, which was incredibly overworked at that point. So it was a very sort of rational, pragmatic, technocratic approach that just kind of said, fines will fix it. And I mean, certainly that we are seeing fewer and fewer people every year go to prison for fine default. I mean, it's barely anything now. But I don't quite know if we haven't sort of missed what's going on in that level. And I wonder if sometimes we've missed what's going on in that level because so much of what is going on in that level is financial. And therefore there are potentially a set of assumptions. And I do think there are still a set of assumptions about what it means to get a fine. I think the phrase that comes to mind is a taken for grantedness. I think there seems to be something very taken for granted about fines and financial punishment. Maybe this is a controversial thing to say, but I think some of the taken for grantedness has to do with criminology and the way that we are still approaching a lot of these. I join Fergus McNeill in his assertion that we need to start looking at the links and overlaps between different forms of punishment rather than looking at them just in isolation. And I think we could really consciously include work on financial punishment within that. And that's, again, one of the reasons why I tried to include a community justice perspective. Because not only can you actually get a financial penalty alongside a community sentence, but there are lots of kind of ad hoc and informal overlaps in terms of people being on community sentences while they're also paying off fines or receiving a fine whilst they're also in the process of, undertaking a community sentence. So I think that if there was perhaps slightly less siloing, and I think we can sometimes be guilty of this because we all have our pockets and that's what we do. But I think we would have a really good chance of creating much more holistic and in some cases accurate accounts of contemporary punishment, and potentially coming up with new and sort of radical findings about how the model and the structure works all together, if that makes sense.
Absolutely, yes. That definitely does make sense. And I think certainly we are sometimes guilty of siloing ourselves a bit into our specialist areas. Of course, you know, the book is divided into chapters based on types of punishment, so perhaps we're playing into that a bit ourselves. You've touched a few times on the ways in which fines might impact on different groups of people differently and how they might be implicated in patterns of inequalities in the UK. I wonder if you could expand on that quite large topic.
Okay, so what my research doesn't do and won't do at this point is tell you this is how, you know, here is a group of people and this is how fines affect them differently to this group. And the reason for that is, again, we don't have that much of a tradition of that kind of work at all. A good example, of course, is women. So, and I hope I'm going to say this, and then I really want someone to prove me wrong. But to my knowledge, I haven't found one that challenges this. The last piece of research that considered women and fines, especially, was from 1989. I know that there's work in America, work in the States, that is really kind of trying to wrestle with that, but as it stands, we don't really know, for example, if there are gender specific experiences, outcomes, or elements to fining. And it's striking to me that we know that economic marginalization is a key motivator of women's offending, and we also know that fines and financial penalties are primarily used to respond to types of offenses that high numbers of women are typically convicted of. And in many cases, these offences are directly linked to forms of economic marginalisation. Shoplifting is a good example, and as is the criminalised sale of sex. These are, you know, I think there's so much fertile ground to have conversations about efficacy, again, efficacy and ethics, especially of finding women. And it's striking that we're not quite there yet, given that there is now so much contemporary criminological research concerning women's experiences of other forms of punishment that reveals distinct and gender-specific dimensions. You know, it's around in 2021 to 22, 50% of women sentenced received a fine, and it's 47%, far and away the most common and most prevalent. And again, within the specific sort of rhetorical policy climate where we are having these really interesting and worthwhile discussions across policy and research about gender-specific and gender-responsive justice, it's interesting to me that we aren't really expanding the holistic kind of definition of punishment to include the most common outcome for women as per statistics. Overall, I think the point of my research is to say there is a bifurcation of process and also potentially outcomes that is only affecting people on the whole who cannot afford to pay. I always think about shoplifting, and actually, as we know, shoplifting's been in the news recently. For massive increases in shoplifting during the cost of living crisis. And for me, that is a perfect sort of demonstration. I think when we think about what's happening at summary level justice, we think it's kind of trivial business, petty crime. But the fact is that these petty crimes are most of what the criminal legal system is responding to. One of the reasons why fines and financial penalties are so common and prevalent is because fundamentally most offending is not hugely violent or a huge affront to the social order. It's often things like acquisitive crimes and crimes that are linked to addiction or substance misuse.
Given that they are so commonly used and so pervasive in all of these different ways, Why do you think it is that fines and other forms of financial penalty are still so understudied and under-discussed, other than by you, of course?
It's nice. I mean, it's nice because I think this is an anecdote, but I think this kind of speaks to it. And I am almost always the only criminologist in the room that is talking about fines, hence the reason I feel like I talk so much about them. I do still think so much theory is dominated by models of punishment that are heavily influenced by imprisonment. And that is the kind of that is the standard, you know, fines research argument, right? Why is criminology so uninterested in fines and financial penalties? Well, because a lot of our really influential theoretical models are developed from research in prison and philosophizing about the experience of prison. And again, you know, I would really highly recommend that all criminologists read a bit of Peter Young's work, because it really kind of, I think it can be really confronting, especially if you are doing punishment work, which is very like focused on prison and imprisonment. It's a really interesting counterpoint. Peter Young was Scotland's kind of, you know, fine scholar, and he did a set of work in the 80s that was actually based off his doctoral thesis, which was about fines. And he makes a kind of broad case about the relationship, about models, exemplars of punishment and how pervasive they can be, and how prison is a very pervasive example that is used to model a lot of what we talk about. And so sometimes we talk about things that aren't imprisonment, like compared to imprisonment. So the assumption is that because it's not prison, therefore it's fundamentally somehow inherently better. I think what we need to be aware of, and I'm going to probably misquote here, but you know, criminology struggles to deconstruct crime, right? Like that's our big sort of dilemma. And what I like about studying fines and financial punishment is that I think they lift the lid on something that seems very everyday and very boring in some cases, unfortunately. And it really says day to day, what are our criminal legal systems doing? And day to day, they are processing huge numbers of people and producing huge numbers of outcomes for all kinds of different people. And I think that in some ways, engaging with fines and financial punishments might, if more work was done, kind of remove some of the emphasis we often put on criminalized people who go to prison. And like, I would love to see another study about TV license evasion. I'd love to see a study about getting a fine for lie tipping. I'd love to see a sort of comparative. Are there more serious offences that are still receiving fines in our courts? I think all of that work is really, really worthwhile. It's really nice when people are like, God, that sounds so interesting. But I'm like, yeah, but it's still just me.
I know we're getting towards the end of our time, and I thought it might be good to ask you a bit about PhD life. We're interviewing a few different people for this book, and you know, practitioners and activists and various others and researchers as well, to try and, one of the things we're trying to do with that is to give a sense of the range of possible career options that studying criminology, that investigating criminal justice can lead you into. So if it'd be okay, I'd just like to ask a few questions about your experiences of the PhD.
Sure.
Can you just tell us a bit about how you came to start doing it?
After I did my undergraduate, I took about 7 years or so away from academia. I'll just own up right now. I do not have a sociology or criminology background. I got my undergraduate in arts and proud of it. But I came back to do a master's at Glasgow when I was 28. And to be honest with you, at that point in my life, I just wanted to do something I felt would challenge me. I wish I could say I had a big master plan. But honestly, I've just always been really fascinated by the criminal legal system, and I guess probably maybe a little cliche to say it, but I wanted to do something where I felt like I could be a little bit useful, even just a teeny tiny bit useful. So after being on the course and writing my master's dissertation, which is also about fines, it was suggested to me that there was potential for a PhD in my work. And so I applied through the Economic Social Research Council open competition, and much to my total surprise, I was successful. I want to make clear that without that funding, it probably would not have been possible for me to do this. And that part was pretty scary and stressful. And I won't lie about that. However, getting it was amazing and life-changing. And then I started my PhD at the end of 2019. So I kind of just went straight from master's and then into a PhD. I also did an MSc, not an MRes. So I had to do some extra catching up in terms of really in terms of methods training. That was primarily what I did. So that's how I got into it. It was one of those things. I took a chance and things sort of came from it.
Great. Would you have any advice for people who might be thinking about a PhD after university?
So I would say, I've got two pieces of advice. But the first one is, I would say to really think carefully about what interests you about your topic and what makes you care about it. You are going to spend years immersed in one exact thing. So it helps to be clear on why you want to study that exact thing. And the reason I say that is there will be times, and maybe Jamie will be like, that's fine. There'll be times when your passion for the topic is pretty much what's getting you through. And so being really clear, maybe it's not your passion for the topic necessarily, although I really am passionate about it. I think having your motivations clear can be something you can really draw strength from. So do have a little think about that. And then the second thing, if you are doing a PhD, is to seek out and draw upon people who really support and inspire you. I was blessed with two of the most supportive and just really knowledgeable supervisors. And, you know, I did my PhD over the pandemic. So there were times that we really needed to kind of be supportive. And they've repeatedly just given me the confidence to own my research and to see it as important and necessary. But equally, getting to be around colleagues through networks like the Scottish Centre for Crime and Justice Research, who are doing fascinating work, including things that have absolutely nothing to do with fines, so different, has for me produced unexpected and really valuable directions in my own work. So my advice there is try to break out of your own PhD bubble as much as possible, because you actually don't know what will inspire like a new thought or a new approach or just a different take on something you're stuck with. So that is my advice.
Great. Well, I think all that remains is to ask if you had anything else to add or anything that we've not covered yet.
No, I mean, I just really like to say thank you to you and the team. As I said, there are so few opportunities that I get to talk about fines and financial punishments in a kind of dedicated way. So I'm really, really grateful for the chance to talk about the work and to raise some questions. I hope raise some questions and some interest about the topic.
Definitely raising some questions and getting people not to take fines for granted. So, very happy to have you on, Amy, and thank you so much for speaking to us today.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. This podcast is produced to accompany the textbook Criminal Justice in Scotland by Jamie Buchan, Sarah Anderson and Katrina Morrison, published by Routledge. Many thanks to Dr. Amy Cullen for speaking to us, and to Edinburgh Napier University and the Scottish Centre for Crime and Justice Research for their support and advice. The interview was by Jamie Buchan, who also produced the episode.